Welcome to Technovation, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, president of Meta Strategy, advisor to technology executives, Forbes columnist, book author, and your host. Each episode of Technovation features insights from top executives and thought leaders at the intersection of business, technology, and innovation. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. And please subscribe so you don't miss a thing. Thank you. My guest this week is Pradeep Khosla. Pradeep is the 8th Chancellor of the University of California, San Diego, a public university with nearly 40,000 students and revenues of roughly $5.5 billion. Since becoming Chancellor in 2012, Pradeep has rolled out the first ever strategic plan for the university. Further, he's worked to expand college access and affordability for underserved populations and enhance the university's relationship with the community. Prior to joining UCSD, Pradeep was the Dean of the College of Engineering and Philip and Marcia Dowd University Professor at Carnegie Mellon University. In this interview, Pradeep details the strategic plan he's led. While he cites that he found a great university when he arrived, he knew it was destined for even greater things, and he set out to create a vision to realize that goal. We also discuss how the University of California System schools interact and share best practices, why Pradeep preferred an 8-word strategic plan over a longer form plan, why he misses being a professor, and a variety of other topics. Well, Chancellor, it's great to speak with you today.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you, sir.
It's a pleasure. So, you are the 8th Chancellor of the University of California at San Diego.
That's true.
Having taken the role in August of 2012. Just for context, for those who are listening, University of 39, 40,000-ish students and rising, 20,000 employees, revenues of roughly $5.5 billion, 6 undergraduate colleges, 5 academic divisions, 5 graduate and professional schools, a university of growing influence. And I wonder if you could take a moment and describe the university you found 7 years ago and some of the details of the initial strategic plan you put in place soon thereafter.
Right. So the university I found 7 years ago when I got here was, to begin with, an amazing place. It had close to $1 billion in research portfolio. And in 2012, it was only 52 years old. We were born in 1960. So today we are 59 years old. It had more research than some of the top Ivy League schools in the country. It had more National Academy members than many top places in the country. It was about 25, 27,000 students, I think, maybe 28,000 students, and we have grown to like nearly 40,000. So it was a place that had intrinsic strength. It was primed for greatness. You know, I said this in many of my talks. This university was destined for greatness. It did not become great. It was its destiny. The way this was created, it was clear it had to be great.
And why is that?
Because it was created, first of all, for the first couple of years as a graduate-only institution. And when it was created, the criteria for hiring faculty was a Nobel laureate or a National Academy member. Anything less than that wouldn't cut it. And we have, that DNA has just propagated itself. We hire people with great care to quality. I know many departments would leave their lines open if they don't find the right person, the right quality, and they would not fill it for the sake of filling it. And I, as Chancellor, don't take these lines back just because you didn't fill it. And that perpetuates, I think, a virtuous cycle here.
And that's really interesting. So quite an ambitious beginning and ambitious in terms of the caliber of professors that the organization brought in. I would imagine that any university would love to have that. Now, you've got in fact, just before we started rolling, we were taking a look at the gorgeous campus that you have here right on the Pacific Ocean. You've got some good structural things that others can't replicate, I suppose. But whereas I would imagine, as I say, other universities might have the ambition to hire only Nobel laureates or people who are at the top of their fields, what is it about this university that's been able to realize that vision?
So I think initially this university came out of Scripps Institution of Oceanography, which is like, if not the top two, and certainly the oldest ranked oceanographic institute in the country. Its director, Roger Revell, who was the visionary behind the creation of this place, wanted an academic institution because Scripps Oceanography was primarily a research institute. It's like SRI. So he wanted something like a Caltech behind it. At least that's where the story goes. And so it was created with that vision in mind. So that was a sense of quality that somebody had in mind when this was created.
I alluded a moment ago to the fact that not long after you arrived, you put together the first ever strategic plan for the university. Can you talk a bit about some of the substance of that plan?
Right. So when I got here, like I said, this was a great place. But it was obvious to me that it was destined for bigger greatness. And what I thought was already a very strong platform that we had arrived at without any planning, it was not clear to me, the way I saw the world around me at that time, that we could keep on going without planning and end up in the right place. So my idea of creating a strategic plan had several components to it. One was to provide guiding rails so that the probability of ending up at the right place was higher than if it was a random walk. Secondly, I thought if we could build a plan which people could buy into, they would be energized more than they were. They were already energized enough. And I was kind of right, because the more they got energized, the more they focused on doing the right things. And since then, so in like the last 7 years, our research has gone from nearly 950 million to 1.4 billion. So we've added more in research in 7 years than most institutions have as their total research budget.
Incredible.
Right? And this is no work. There's nothing. I did not do anything about it. This was all the faculty hiring great people working hard, you know, writing big programs and really projecting a great vision. So the whole strategic planning process. So a third part of this process was for me to open a window where I could create a very safe space for people to talk about their dreams or aspirations, their dejections, their, you know, whatever, like unhappiness. I could see in this window, and in about 90 days, I had knowledge worth 10 years of working out here. But I held it against nobody. I just learned and learned and learned, and that was it. And then I forgot who said what. But I just remembered the facts that happened to be true. Right? And that has given me, I think, personally, a great ability to navigate this complex California public university landscape, and also UC San Diego as a campus.
That's interesting. Your role as chancellor, you have the ability to influence it and be part of an ecosystem that has influence, that is really multi-headed. You mentioned the University of California system, arguably the greatest set of public institutions.
Unarguably.
Yeah, yeah. forgive me. Yes, all right. And of course, you have the renowned faculty that you mentioned.
Right.
You have the students. You also have a wide ecosystem of donors, one of the reasons why this institution has done so incredibly well in terms of fundraising.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder, how do you think about each of those constituent groups, and how do you divide your time, spending time with each of them?
So first of all, anything and everything I do, including this interview, to me is propagating the message of the intrinsic strength and the greatness of this place. That's all I do, and I do it shamelessly and with great pride. And once you do that, and it is supported by facts, and it's supported by passion of people around you, it becomes true. And when people perceive it to be true, they want to support you, because everybody wants to bet on a winning horse. And I think what we had not done was talk about why we were winning all the time. We just assumed that was the case the world was, but the world is not that way. So
that's amazing. And it seems as though there's really a virtuous cycle that's been enacted here. You talked about the remarkable research and faculty that date back to the university's founding. We've already talked about the $1.35 billion in sponsored research, as I understand it, the seventh worldwide for public universities.
Right.
You must be very proud. You also second only to UCLA in terms of number of applicants. And so
in the country.
In the entire country of the United States. And so, as I say, this virtuous cycle that seems to be, you know, spinning round and round and improving with each turn, each of those impacting the other, I have to imagine.
Yeah, no, there is. And I think there are many reasons for this cycle. But I think I may want to inject one point, which I think is kind of responsible a little bit. So when we did the strategic plan, most institutions, when they do a strategic plan, it's like a 40-page document. They might make it 20 pages, but nonetheless, it's multi-tens of pages document. It is goals A, B, C, D, E. And some of these goals might be aspirational, but nonetheless, they're goals like we would be number top five in the next 10 years or something like that. When we did this plan, I decided less was more. So the plan was going to be more a framework and not a 20, 30, 40-page document. And the plan was condensed into eight words: student-centered, research-focused, service-oriented, public university. And the interesting part was that everybody who came to work read these eight words. They decided what they meant, the words meant to them in their job, and they did the right thing that day, that month, that year. And there was no top-down mandate of student-centered means you're going to manage 50 students every year or interact with 40 students today. None of that stuff, right? And I tell you, this has empowered the staff and the faculty because there is no top-down mandate. It has become your responsibility to make this a better place, which is a much tougher proposition than me telling you if you work 9 hours, it would be a better place. Then you would check the box and that's it.
Good point.
Right?
Yeah.
So this was the uniqueness about this strategic plan. And there are many institutions now that have copied our quote-unquote framework because this, from what I can tell, was never done before, where less was more, words describe the plan, and few words. So like today, if you ask me, what's your vision? It's one word, destination. So then he said, wait a second, what does it mean, destination? So then I say, Peter, it means for students, for patients, and for the local community. So the first two everybody understands, but people don't understand what does it mean to be a destination for the local community. And then the answer is it's a destination for art, culture, entertainment for broader San Diego. As rich as people think San Diego is in terms of natural beauty and dollar wealth, it's not quite that rich in dollar wealth. So I want us, being a public institution, to be accessible to significant underserved population out here. They have never been to an opera. They have never been to a dance. They have never been to a music show. I want them to be able to enjoy all of this on our campus free of cost.
Very interesting. That's really compelling.
Right.
I want to go back to the UC system more generally speaking. I'm curious, how do the different chancellors of the 10 universities work together? To what extent is their influence drawn from one another, best practices shared versus competition between the other nine, you and the other nine?
So it's all of the above. So every month we meet. We spend a whole day together every month, first Wednesday of every month in Oakland, convened by the president of the system. And this is where we talked about what's going on and exchanging best practices. It's not just us meeting. The executive vice chancellors meet, the CFOs meet, and all of this is enabled by the president's office, and that allows us to share best practices from the chancellor down to the director of admissions, multi-layer strategy of sharing best practices.
Very interesting.
Right.
And I want to also talk about your past. You, prior to this role, you were the dean of the College of Engineering and the Philip and Marcia Dowd University professor at Carnegie Mellon University, also on the short list of one of the great universities in the world, and certainly in the discipline of engineering and your specific disciplines of electrical engineering and computer science. I know you were involved in robotics as well, particularly famous there also. Mm-hmm. Just a remarkable university from a technology perspective. What did you bring? Obviously, you had administrative experience as a result of being dean. You also had academic credentials that were top-notch as well. I'm curious what you draw from your experience as a professor, especially as a professor of technology in your current role.
So what I have drawn is the ability to look at large amounts of information, complex situation, and extract a problem statement and a problem-solving strategy from there. So instead of just thinking deeply about issues, my view is we think deeply about issues and then we work deeply to solve the issue. We just don't keep on talking, right? And I think that is really engineering education, especially I went to Carnegie Mellon for my PhD. So that's what I learned. It was problem-solving strategies and understanding how to articulate complex issues into problems that are solvable and then solving them.
Yeah. It's been quite some time since you were, quote-unquote, just a professor. Do you miss those days ever?
Actually, I do. So when I was a professor, I used to teach freshmen, and that was the most enjoyable. I used to teach freshmen, Introduction to Electrical and Computer Engineering, and then I would teach graduate students robotics. And it was the two extremes. I actually enjoyed both, but I really enjoy teaching freshmen because I think it's the greatest pleasure to take somebody fresh out of school and the ability to teach them complex concepts that everybody thought is, you know, impossible to teach or impossible to learn, and just make it easy.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I know that you've also, speaking of ecosystems, as I referenced before, you personally have a strong ecosystem in the venture community and the startup community as well. You've sat on the boards
right.
of multiple organizations and no doubt drawing from your vast experience both as an academic and as somebody who's been involved in the business world. I'm curious, you know, how you remain abreast of developments from that perspective. You must be so pleased that so many of your former students have gone on to do remarkable things in starting some of the great companies.
Right. So they've done really well.
Yeah.
So it's not quite as easy to remain abreast as one might think. But having said that, I do try, and let me tell you how I try. So first of all, on this campus, a joke, but it's actually serious, I have more than 2,000 people, top people in their areas, willing to give me free tutorials on any topic I want. And I use that very shamelessly. I mean, I run into faculty, I ask questions, I'm asking questions, not because I'm doubting what they're doing. I'm asking questions because I'm trying to learn what they're saying and what they're doing and why they're doing it. And because of that, from somebody who did not care about biology growing up or did not like organic chemistry, if you look at this place, these are the two significant strengths of this place in life sciences.
Yeah.
And I have learned a lot in these areas and become very, how should I say, reasonably adept at least understanding the issues in these areas. So that's one. Secondly, I go to conferences, I meet people, the alumni, I get engaged. So some one way or the other, I'm reasonably abreast of developments, but not as deeply as I would like.
Yeah. And we've talked a bit about the university you found 7 years ago, some of the things you've enacted and the results, the striking results, in many cases actually ahead of schedule or ahead of plan in terms
right.
of progress. Where would you like, let's say, 7 years hence, where would you see the university if you were to accomplish what you hope?
So, you know, 7 years hence, I think, I don't know how to quantify this, but here's what I would like this university to be at, where I would like it to be at, a point where the alumni, the community, own a piece of who we are intellectually, emotionally, and physically. I can interpret that multiple different ways, but when I see that type of ownership of our existence from somebody else's point of view, then I know that we have grabbed the mind share that we wanted to grab, and over time we'd become a household name.
That's great. Well, Chancellor Pradeep Khosla, thank you so much for joining me on Technovation today. It's inspiring to hear all that you've accomplished from your years as an academic, from your leadership positions as a dean, and now as a chancellor of a major university. Congratulations and best wishes.
Now, thank you, and thank you for doing this. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thanks for tuning in. Please join me next week when my guest will be Stephen Schwarzman, the founder and CEO of Blackstone. And as 2019 comes to a close, I wanted to give a heartfelt thank you to all of our loyal listeners. We were recently named to FeedSpot's list of top 10 must-listen CIO podcasts of 2019, and this would not have been possible without your support. If you found our content to be valuable, I'd greatly appreciate it if you give us a ratings on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you again, and happy holidays.